trigger warning. This episode contains references to child physical and sexual abuse. Please listen with discretion.
You know exactly what I do, Lieutenant. When Whitfarrow builds something, I'm the one who lets out the bids. I hire the subcontractors. I make the best deal I can on everything from concrete to grass seed.
Oh, I see. You're the one who makes sure that nobody steals a couple of bricks or a bag of sand, right?
Exactly.
You still didn't answer my question. How about those two spicy meatballs out there?
People try to buy me. They pressure me at times. I could make a businessman rich with a phone call.
Uh-huh. How about Jacoby? What can you do for him with a phone call?
You mean hurt him? Why would I want to do that? He was a bright young lawyer. He came up with a lot of new clever tax gimmicks.
I see. And he was clever enough to find his way into your private books. He discovered that you had a couple of $1 million worth of sandbags in your private Swiss bank account. Hey, those are public funds. You can get into a lot of trouble and be sent up for a long time skimming off the top.
What do you think you're talking about?
What do you think you're talking about? What do I think I'm talking about? Talk about murder, dummy.
Every law enforcement community has their closer, the tough guy officer who takes a lead on an investigation thanks to his or her uncanny ability to close cases no one else can seem to. Sometimes these closers step into an investigation when the trail has gone cold, the case having come to a standstill. Oftentimes, the closer is tapped from a different, bigger, better resourced agency, and they come with a reputation for being uncompromising, intimidating, and able to solve a crime and nail the perp every single time, by hook or by crook. These folks are legendary in their circles. Other officers take a back seat to them, tell tales about them, and shake their head in wonder at them. Ironically, we see these local legends a lot in wrongful conviction cases, I'd say in at least half of the ones we've looked at, which isn't surprising. Because one of the side effects of being a legend is having an ego to match. You can end up with officers who believe their gut over the evidence before them, and of course their colleagues fall in line like lemmings, unwavering in their trust of the legend's inexplicable powers. Which is why it sometimes leads to disastrous results, like charging and convicting an innocent person of a crime they didn't commit. And that's what happened in this case. After spending nearly 6 months investigating Sharon Johnson's murder, the investigators in charge hadn't made a single arrest. They circled their prime suspect, Ken Johnson, in every way possible, but never felt they had enough to nail him. Hard to believe, I know. Former trooper Thomas Sexton explained to me that the New Hampshire legal community was very conservative when it came to bringing charges and prosecuting crimes. Murder charges weren't thrown around willy-nilly. There had to be a real provable case for the prosecution to proceed.
The New Hampshire Attorney General's office has always been very conservative, and when I say that, I mean they don't just charge people with homicide unless they think they have a 100% chance of getting a conviction, because they realize that once there's a not guilty finding, you can't charge them again. So they're going to wait and wait and wait till they think they have a 100% case.
When it came to Ken Johnson, there were mountains of circumstantial evidence. Ken had no alibi. He placed himself in the vicinity of the crime. He was identified by a witness as being seen with Sharon on Auto Center Road on the night of the murder. He stood to gain a substantial financial sum upon her death, and he repeatedly lied to the police and others about his whereabouts. Yet the police just didn't believe they had enough to charge him. No murder weapon, no forensic evidence, no witnesses to the murder itself, and no confession. The knife found in Ken's car was found to have no blood on it, and the mud on his car, while consistent with mud from the general area where Sharon was found, didn't match the exact composition of mud from the crime scene. And so, having hit a dead end, they brought in a local legend, an officer who was known for being diligent, brilliant, and principled in his own way. The officer they called Kojak. Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed. This is episode 5 of The State versus Jason Carroll. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of Adnan's Story, and I'm here with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Had done a fairly extensive job in the initial investigation into Sharon's murder, interviewing dozens and dozens of people, often multiple times, chasing down every lead, even the leads that turned out to be wild goose chases that Ken had sent them on. Other than failing to search the Johnson home or vicinity, or to check Ken's physical person for signs of being involved in a struggle, investigators seemed to have done everything else they could have, even offering a reward and otherwise eliciting the public's help. But by the late fall of 1988, the investigation was petering out. Only 2 reports were filed in November, and not a single one in December. The very first police report that reflects that the case had been turned over to a new lead investigator is dated January 26, 1989. It's a short interview of Melanie Eaton, Sharon's daughter, and the report of that interview was created by legendary detective Sergeant Roland Lammy of the New Hampshire State Police's Major Crime Unit.
There was a fellow who thought he was Kojak or something, with a wallet, the whole deal. And
yep. Everybody's talked about him. His name is Lammy, Detective Lammy.
Did you ever meet Roland?
I have not met him. I've just heard lots of descriptions, and we have reached out. We've reached out to him, and I'm hoping he'll call me back. He has my number now.
He's an interesting call, I tell you.
Oh, what, tell me about him. He was a lead investigator.
He's a great guy, great, great investigator, but he was crazy as hell. Great, he would do anything to solve a case. Like, if people wouldn't come out and talk to him, somebody might have pulled a fire alarm to get people out of the building. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I heard he was a closer, basically. He just...
Yeah, he was good. He was good, no doubt about it. He was awesome.
Roland, he was 6'4", huge broad shoulders, completely bald, and he had a twitch in his right shoulder. When he interrogated somebody, they always confessed to him. People were scared to death of Roland. They really were. Even half the state policemen were scared of Roland. He wound up investigating our colonel one time, and the colonel got fired because Lammy found out he was doing something. Lammy was not afraid of anybody. He'd go after the governor if he had information on him. And he was extremely successful in cracking cases.
Kojak may have been an iconic television detective, but the actor who played the character, Telly Savalas, wasn't nearly as intimidating as Sergeant Lammy himself. Lammy towered 6'4" tall, a solid 260 pounds, and stood a half foot taller than the TV detective. When Sergeant Lammy entered a room, people noticed. Lammy's career was storied, his achievements celebrated. In 1975, Lammy helped clear a case involving 80 burglaries and thousands of dollars of stolen merchandise across several counties. The Pembroke police chief said at the time that Lammy was, quote, one of the sharpest men I've ever worked with, and that the state was lucky to have him. That same year, Lammy helped solve a rash of arson cases that spanned years, starting in the 1960s and ending when Lammy was able to match a tire print from a scene to a suspect. The fires were so frequent that firefighters had been threatening to quit, because they went for months without any weekends off. Finally, thanks to Lammy, they nailed the culprit in quite the plot twist. The arsonist was a firefighter who had set fires so that he could get extra hours and pay to support his family. And then, of course, there were the murder cases. When Lammy testified at the trial of Jason Carroll a few years later, he told the jury that he'd handled around 40 homicide investigations, and that he was regularly assigned to a particular kind of case.
The kind of cases that I come to be assigned to are cases that have come to a dead end, that another lead investigator or another investigation seems to get bogged down with a lack of direction, or just simply the case has gone cold. Over my career in the last, particularly since the mid-70s, I've been assigned regularly to pick up cases that have come to that kind of an ending. In other words, it simply has no life left to it.
Why is it that that has become your particular responsibility?
Well, one of the reasons I'd suspect is that throughout the years I've accumulated a good base of experience in homicides. It's pretty much what I've done the majority of my career. The different administrations that have directed me to do this have told me that I'm persistent. I operate with the feeling. My motivator is that having seen the effect of these homicides on families, and sometimes some homicides go unsolved, and having witnessed what it does to people, I feel motivated very strongly in pursuing all possible avenues in a very persistent manner, till I've been able to eliminate all of the available or known factors.
It's no wonder, then, that Lammy came to have the reputation that he did. He was the best closer in New Hampshire.
Lammy explained to the jury that the case had gone through the hands of 6 or 7 investigators because of structural changes in the chain of command, and that it led to a failure of continuity in the investigation. The investigation, said Lammy, had big, big problems. No real plan, and no real transmission of a strategy from one lead to another. Lammy's initial objective was to interview the officers who had worked in the case and get a feel for the factors at play. Greed or sex or infidelity, anger, insurance, and whatnot, said Lammy. The first thing that leapt out at Lammy during his initial review was the question of the relationship between Ken and his adopted daughter Lisa Johnson. And so he interviewed the folks who would have the most information about them and also about Sharon and Ken's marriage. Soon after taking over the case, Lammy interviewed Diane Eaton, Sharon's sister-in-law, and the woman who had taken Melanie to Weight Watchers on the night that her mother was murdered. Diane had some very interesting things to tell Lammy. She told him that about 2 weeks before the murder, Ken started calling her at the house, which was not something he had ever done before. Ken told her that Kathy Hampson, Sharon's close friend, had begun coming over while Sharon was at work, and that Ken and Kathy would read books together.
Reading books with him? I worked with him sometimes, like I said. You know, I mean, I went and did log splitting and stuff with him, but to just go hang out with him? No. I didn't know. No, I don't know where that came from, but I definitely went and did log splitting and stuff with him to make extra money and stuff, but it was no, I didn't have like I said, it wasn't some desire to go hang out with him. It was a way to make money, and I just keeping the peace. She was my friend. You know, she's married to him. I had to tolerate him being there because that's the way it was. And that was my attitude towards him.
At the time, Diane had no idea what to make of this information. But her gut feeling was that Ken hoped that Diane would tell his wife to make her jealous or to ruin her friendship with Kathy. She ignored the information, however, and never passed it on to Sharon. And then, after the murder, it got weirder, Diane told Sergeant Lammy. Ken began calling her frequently and told her he had begun to read the Bible. Ken told Diane that God said they must forgive whoever killed Sharon, and Diane responded she would never forgive that person. Ken never called back after Diane told him that. Most interesting to Sergeant Lammy was the comment that Diane made about Ken's daughter Lisa. She told the officer that Lisa was always sitting in Ken's lap, and they were touchy-feely beyond what seemed appropriate. Lammy spoke to Ken's own brother, who also told him the same thing, that there was some strange rivalry that Lisa felt towards Sharon, provoking her into fights and often sitting in her father's lap and showing affection to Ken that made others uncomfortable. In fact, Lisa had become visibly upset at the funeral, not because they were burying Sharon, but because she saw her father holding hands with Kathy Hampson. Now, this is a detail that popped up in numerous interviews of people who attended the funeral, that Ken and Kathy were holding hands. And it spawned more than one rumor, and even made the police suspicious for a short while.
And it was really weird because I never would have done anything against her, you know, and people, I was cute back then, I can't say at 61 I look like I used to, but you know, people used to accuse, oh, you're having an affair with him, you're doing this and that, and I'm like, that is so untrue. You know what I, like, there was no way the way I felt about him that I would ever, ever cross that line. And I started hearing people make comments and, you know, and it was just, are you kidding me? You know what I mean? Like, no, that's the last thing that I would want to do. And so they kind of questioned me about that for a while. It didn't take them long to realize that I had nothing to do with it, you know, because I, like I said, I'm about as transparent as you can get, and I'll tell you the way it is. But yeah, they didn't hassle me for very long.
Whatever the truth happened to be about Kathy, Lammy's gut told him something very fishy was going on here between dad and daughter. Ken, Lammy decided, was the father of Lisa's baby.
Were you ever aware that the state's theory, that the lead investigator believed that Ken killed Sharon because Sharon walked in on you and him having an inappropriate relationship?
Oh, dear God. I remember them suggesting that I was pregnant from my father, and I remember feeling disgusted, angry, and I was like, how could you people even think that? But I never heard about Sharon walking in.
She's not wrong. How could Lammy think that? Especially since it was no secret who Lisa's baby's father was. As early as August 4th, just a few days after the murder, Melanie had told the police that a man named Tony was the baby's father. But Lammy wouldn't have known that because, according to his own testimony, he didn't really spend much time reviewing the early reports. Instead, he preferred to get the general sense of the case from talking to the previous investigators and then take it from there. In fact, on cross-examination, he admitted to not being aware that potential evidence, like knives, had been turned in by the public in response to the police asking for help. From his testimony, it seemed as if Lammy didn't give much weight to the initial investigation, and because of that, he didn't really pay much attention to those early reports, the very ones that contained Ken's statements and information about his movements. If Lammy had read those reports, maybe the case wouldn't have taken such a left turn. Maybe Lammy would have focused on Ken and Ken alone. But instead, the investigation went off the deep end. Now, to be fair, Lammy wasn't the first one to suggest that Ken might be the father of Lisa's baby. A few weeks after the murder, a very angry Ken told Trooper Thomas Sexton that he'd heard that the police were asking others if Ken was the father. Sexton told Ken that someone had suggested this, but it turned out to be a misquote. They knew the allegation was baseless and that the police apologized for it. Again, maybe Lammy would have known about this if he had thoroughly reviewed those earlier reports, or maybe it wouldn't have mattered to him. He was certain Ken was responsible for Sharon's murder, and his theory was that Ken had Sharon killed because she found out the sordid truth about his relationship with Lisa. The problem with that theory was that everyone Sergeant Lammy interviewed told him that the baby's daddy was a young man named Harry Anthony Pfaff, who was known to everyone by the name Tony. Lammy tracked down Tony's ex-girlfriend, who told him that Tony was an alcoholic and transient. He didn't have a permanent home, and he bounced from one place to another. If he found out the police were looking for him, he would definitely run. But if there was anyone who knew where Tony was, it would be his aunt and uncle, Debbie and George Gagnon. The next day, Sergeant Lammy found Tony's aunt and uncle and interviewed them. The report of the interview is pretty chock full of information about Tony. The Gagnons shared 18-year-old Tony's date of birth, his social security number, his mother's address, even his driver's license number. They described him as being around 5'7" tall, with brown hair and brown eyes and a fair complexion. Tony was close to them, but them alone, admitted his aunt and uncle, because the rest of the family had given up on him. He was indeed an alcoholic, and he always seemed to be getting into trouble. Debbie and George shared a lot about Tony, but the one thing they couldn't share was his location. They told Sergeant Lammy they had no idea where Tony was, and gave him Tony's grandmother's number to check there. It turned out the grandmother didn't know where he was either, but last she had heard, he had been living in Wilmington, North Carolina. Now, Lammy didn't believe that Tony's family had no way of contacting him, so he tried another tactic. He called the aunt and uncle back and told them that Tony might have AIDS. Remember, this is the late 1980s, when the very word AIDS caused panic and fear in people. When Sergeant Lammy testified about this years later, he admitted that he used this unconventional, and some would argue unethical, method to get to Tony. But he said he did draw a line. He didn't say for sure that Tony had AIDS, only that he might. And for all Lammy knew, maybe Tony did, which justified the ruse for him. The real question here is this, though. Why was Sergeant Lammy so invested in finding Tony as part of his murder investigation? What possible connection did Lammy think Tony could have? Tony's name had never ever come up in the investigation before as a potential lead or suspect, or having any information or involvement at all with the murder. But it seems that Lammy's gut told him there was something there. His instinct paid off. The Gagnons gave Sergeant Lammy Tony's phone number, and on March 1st, 1989, Tony Pfaff gave his first confession.
My name's Laura Engstrand. A friend of mine, Lisa Johnson, let me know that you might want to speak to me. Tony Pfaff was my brother.
Harry Anthony Pfaff, better known as Tony, was born in Jacksonville, North Carolina in 1970, and was raised with his older sister, Laura. Laura was the eldest of five, and she and Tony had other siblings, but the family was split apart. Tony and Laura stayed together for a few years as children, while the other siblings were raised separately.
We were raised in Allenstown, New Hampshire, at the Holiday Acres Trailer Park.
By your parents?
By my dad. My mom wasn't in the picture at the time. Well, there was a few things about that, but my dad never let us visit my mom. He'd always dangle us in front of her, tell her that she'd have visitation, and then she'd come and meet him, and he would tell her no, and I would have rather been raised by my mom.
Their father was an abusive alcoholic that terrorized the children.
When Tony and I were underneath the trailer, we had this little Ford underneath the stairs, and he was shooting a gun through the floorboard. He didn't know where we were, and he came close to shooting both Tony and I. So he was bad. He was just a drunk.
Even more horrific, their father had begun sexually assaulting Laura when she was 9 years old, which he forced 6-year-old Tony to watch. And he also eventually began raping and molesting Tony as well.
I left when I was 13. My mom came and picked my brother and I up from North Carolina because we moved when I was 12 years old to North Carolina. And then on my 13th birthday, my mom came and got us, moved back to New Hampshire with her. My mom couldn't handle Tony, so he went back to my dad, and I stayed with my mom.
So since that age, you guys were raised separately?
Yeah.
When Laura finally escaped to her mother's house, Tony was 9 years old. He ended up alone, fending for himself against a violent drunk. It's no surprise that by the time Tony was a teenager, he was getting into regular trouble and was a full-blown alcoholic himself. The pain of his childhood trauma never left him.
You know, he struggled all his life, I think, with this and other things that have happened to us when we were children, you know, and he just couldn't deal with it. He couldn't deal with my rape and all that. So, yeah, I think that's what did him in.
It's important to both know Tony's background and to remember that at the time Sharon Johnson was murdered, Tony was only 18 years old. The case documents call him a man, but by most measures, he was still a child. When Sergeant Lammy got a hold of Tony, he'd been staying with a friend in Wallace, North Carolina. Lammy noted that Tony seemed nervous, asked random questions, and he told Lammy that he hadn't seen Lisa in over a year, meaning he also hadn't seen their baby since she'd had it. Tony's relationship with Lisa was, of course, not great, considering that he'd been dodging making child support payments. The baby, he confirmed to Lammy, was definitely his. And no, he hadn't ever heard a thing about any relationship between Lisa and Ken. It wasn't until the end of the conversation that Sergeant Lammy brought up Sharon Johnson's murder. That's when Tony spilled information that Lammy never could have guessed was coming.
Tony told Sergeant Lammy in July of 1988 he was living with a woman named Karen Poulin, but only for a couple of weeks. He didn't have a permanent home and bounced around from one place to another for a few weeks at a time. Lisa and him were on the outs, and he heard she'd moved back to Rhode Island with her mother, but had no contact information for her. Tony had been working and finally had some money he wanted to give Lisa for herself and the baby. So on Friday, July 29th, the day that Sharon's body was found, Tony called the Johnson home looking for Lisa. Ken picked up the phone and told Tony he would give him Lisa's contact information only if he did him a favor. Ken told him that his wife's car was parked in front of Don's Sports Center store on South Willow Street in Manchester, and the keys were under the seat. Ken asked him to move the car from in front of the sports shop to the parking lot next to the Sears and leave it there. And so that evening, around 8 p.m., Tony went to the movie theater on South Willow Street with some friends. His friends went inside the theater, and Tony walked to Don's Sports Center and found Sharon's car. He then moved the car as Ken had asked him to do, put the keys under the front seat where he had found them, left the door unlocked, and then walked to the movie theater to join his friends. The next morning, said Tony, his friend Doug Roberts drove him to the Johnson's house, and Ken came out into the porch and handed him a piece of paper with Lisa's number and Rhode Island address on it. Tony and Doug then traveled to Rhode Island the very next day to see Lisa, but it didn't go well. Apparently, Tony had no idea at the time that he moved the car that Sharon had been murdered. He didn't learn of the news until the weekend, and when he did realize he might have moved a murdered woman's car, he was too scared to contact the police. Sergeant Lammy informed Tony that arrangements would be made for his travel back to New Hampshire, presumably in order to assist with the investigation. And then the report ends in a curious note. It reads, quote, "See Sergeant Norris's report of his initial contact with Tony Pfaff with regard to inconsistencies that exist between his initial account of Ken Johnson asking him to move the car and the Doug Roberts inconsistency." Now, this note was clearly added to the report at least 8 days later, when Sergeant Norris did actually talk to Doug Roberts. According to Doug, he knew Tony Pfaff for about 2 years. They were roommates for a few months, but Tony was an alcoholic and also a thief that had stolen money from him, after which Doug moved out and stopped talking to him. This would have been around the beginning of June 1988. Doug then moved around from one place to another for the rest of the summer, and in September moved back home with his parents. Doug remembered Tony's girlfriend Lisa and recalled that Lisa's father gave Tony a very hard time. Ken ragged on Tony to the bone, called him names, and humiliated him. Doug had been to Lisa's house a few times with Tony, using the evenings to pick him up, but beyond that didn't seem to know much about the relationship. Sergeant Norris pressed Doug to spill anything on Tony he had. Had Tony told him of his involvement with a murder, or of any nefarious activity he'd been involved with that summer at all? Doug tried to give Norris what he was asking for, but failed over and over. Was it that Tony drove without a license? Or that Tony was fooling around with another man? Or the big fight Tony had one night in the street? Or was it the time that Tony broke into someone's basement? Nope, it was none of that, said Sergeant Norris. He then tried another tack. Did Doug ever remember dropping Tony off on South Willow Street close to the mall in June or July? Doug responded no. They had parted ways by then. If he ever saw Tony around after they stopped living together, Tony would flip him a middle finger. Did Doug know anything about the Sharon Johnson murder, asked Sergeant Norris. Doug responded no, only that she'd been murdered and that was about it. Tony hadn't shared anything about the murder with him. In fact, Doug had forgotten about the whole thing until Sergeant Norris had brought it up now. Finally, Doug said he never visited the Johnson home with Tony after Sharon was killed, because they didn't hang out at all after June of 1988. Doug's statement to Sergeant Norris isn't just full of inconsistencies as compared to Tony's, it's completely different altogether. Doug and Tony weren't even on speaking terms at the time that Tony said that Doug drove him to Ken's house to get Lisa's contact information. Basically, Doug was useless to the police. They had to find another way to corroborate Tony's statements, and so they launched a sting operation to get to the very heart of the matter. Ken.
By this time, Ken had moved to Rhode Island, having sold the house that Sharon had worked so hard to buy. Tony was transported to Rhode Island from North Carolina, courtesy of the New Hampshire State Police, and was immediately put to task. He had to get Ken to admit to asking Tony to move the car. That's all they needed, but Ken turned out to be wilier than they'd expected. On March 11, 1989, Tony made a recorded call to the Johnson residence, and Lisa and Ken both picked up the phone from different lines. The transcript of the call shows how it got awkward for Tony. He needed to get Ken to say something incriminating, but also to keep Lisa out of it. Tony tried being subtle. He told Ken that he needed to talk to him about the car, and Ken responded, "What car?" "The car you asked me to move," Tony responded. Ken then asked, "Who is this?" acting like he didn't recognize Tony's voice. "What car I asked you to move?" Ken continued. Tony tried another ploy. "You and I both know exactly what I'm talking about. They got my prints on the car," he told Ken. But Ken refused to play ball. He kept repeating that he had no idea what Tony was talking about and that he didn't understand what Tony was saying. Lisa interjected at one point and asked Tony to tell her what was going on, but he told her to stay out of it and not to get involved. After a few more back and forths, Ken told Tony that the police had just visited him and that he was getting a restraining order against Tony. "Don't come near their place," said Ken, "and don't call back." Tony didn't back down, though, likely encouraged by the officers in the room with him. He asked Ken to meet him for just 5 minutes at the Swiss Chalet where he was staying. Ken said okay and then hung up. An hour later, Tony called Ken again, and Ken asked him to hand the phone to the police officer that he assumed was standing next to Tony. Clearly, Ken was onto the sting. Lisa then gets on the line, and Tony tells her he will call her back to answer her questions. When he does, he admits to her that Ken had asked him to move Sharon's car back in July, and that whether or not Lisa believed it, Ken had definitely killed Sharon. They spend most of the call with Tony practically begging Lisa to connect him to Ken, and Lisa refusing to do so. A few hours later, Tony tries again, and again Lisa tells him that she can't get Ken on the line for him because now she doesn't know where he is. At this point, she's beginning to believe maybe that her father was involved in the murder, and tells Tony that if Ken did do it, then he deserves to be put away. She loves him dearly, she says, and hopes to God he didn't do it, but if Ken did do it, he should go to prison for it.
The next day, Tony kept trying to get a hold of Ken, calling the house where Ken lived repeatedly. After 4 calls, Ken finally talked to him and agreed to meet him at a hotel parking lot. Tony threatened that if Ken didn't show up, he'd go to the police. Ken doesn't show up, and Tony calls again. And again. At some point, though, Ken gave in, and they finally met that evening. A meeting that unfortunately did not get recorded. But after the meeting, as Tony debriefed the investigators about what Ken and he had spoken about, Sergeant Norris got a message that someone wanted to talk to him. That someone turned out to be Ken Johnson, who was calling to report to the police that he had met a young man named Tony Pfaff, the father of his daughter's baby. According to Ken, Tony admitted to moving Sharon's car after she was murdered. During the meeting, Tony accused Ken of telling him to move the car, but of course Ken told Sergeant Norris he never asked Tony to do any such thing. Norris then asked Ken if he had ever met Tony after the murder, and Ken said no. The last time he ever saw Tony was months before the murder. Sergeant Norris ultimately asked Ken to come into the police station to give his statement, but Ken refused, telling him he needed a few days to clear his head. Norris tried to convince him of the urgency of the matter, of how important to solving Sharon's murder this information was, but again, Ken flatly refused to meet in person. The next day, Norris spoke to Ken again, and again, asked Ken to come to the station. Norris told Ken he couldn't understand why he had such important, relevant information about the murder of his wife that he wouldn't come into the station. Again, Ken refused, saying he needed to clear his head. Ken's head, though, never did clear up, because after that, he refused to talk to the investigators about the meeting with Tony. And despite the many attempts at getting anything incriminating from Ken on tape, their sting failed.
It took a long time for me to understand why, at this point in the investigation, Sergeant Lamy decided to turn his attention from Ken Johnson to Tony Pfaff instead, but then I took a step back to view the bigger picture. First, it's not unusual in cases of confessions for investigators to believe that the person who's confessed to something is still likely hiding more about their involvement in a crime, especially someone who already has a history of being on the wrong side of the law. When the police looked at Tony, they saw someone who had a troubled past, left New Hampshire shortly after the murder, failed to come forward to report Ken's actions after he learned about the murder, had a direct personal connection to the Johnsons, and now had confessed to having an inadvertent part in the crime. It made sense to them that if he was willing to volunteer this much information, over the phone no less, there was likely more that he wasn't telling them. But there was an even more significant reason for Sergeant Lamy to focus on Tony now. Frankly, he had nothing solid on Ken. Yes, it was true that Ken had means, motive, and opportunity, yet they had no weapon tying him to the crime, no witnesses, no forensic evidence from his car, and no confession. Ken lied a lot to the police, but those lies weren't evidence. Now, I would argue that Tony's statement alone about moving the car may have been enough to convict Ken, but remember what Thomas Sexton said about conservative New Hampshire prosecutors? They don't bring charges until and unless they're truly sure they can get the charges to stick. Now, in cases like this where the police feel certain that someone is behind a crime but they cannot nail the suspect, they sometimes go looking for the next best thing, that the suspect paid someone else to commit the murder. And thus, a conspiracy is born, which is what happened here. After investigators failed to get Ken to implicate himself, they turned their sights fully on Tony. For months, the investigation seemed to revolve only around learning as much as they could about Tony's lifestyle, connection, and movements. They spoke to everyone they knew that hung out with Tony, partied with him, lived with him briefly, hated him. A year after the murder, the investigators began asking dozens of people whether Tony suddenly came into money at the end of July 1988, and a few of them faintly recalled that he did, or at least that they heard that he did. Others told the police that Tony threw lavish parties at hotels with that newfound money, parties that they recall happening in September or October of 1988, parties that wouldn't have happened because Tony had already moved out of the state. Some heard that Tony had a street fight that summer in which he told his adversary that he had already killed someone and that he'd kill him too. Except once the police talked directly to the man that Tony alleged to have threatened, he said that none of it ever happened. One woman told the police that Tony was a weirdo that everyone hated. He thought he was a ninja and always carried a knife on him, and he had once forcibly kissed and groped her, but her boyfriend found them and saved her. Another woman reported that she'd heard Tony was a veritable serial killer, that he'd killed 6 people with a knife and threw one of the bodies in the Merrimack River. And yes, there was talk that he was the one who had stabbed a pregnant woman to death, all for some money. Such a stone-cold killer was he. No one had much nice to say about Tony, though to be fair, many of the folks sharing these sordid rumors about him themselves weren't exactly stellar citizens. One woman who'd heard shady rumors about Tony was actually interviewed from prison, as she awaited trial for murder charges that she herself was facing. The police followed the trail of rumors going from one person to the person they'd heard it from to the person they'd heard the story from, and every time they hit a dead end. And besides, no one was able to give the police any solid information tying Tony to the murder. They were still hoping to find someone to directly connect Tony to the case. And Sergeant Lammy finally got his big break when he began interviewing the people that Tony worked with. And one of them unexpectedly folded like a paper towel, implicating both Tony and himself, a young man by the name of Jason Carroll. Next time on Undisclosed. If you have any information related to this or any of the cases we cover, remember you can reach us on our phone line at 410-205-5563. Once again, that's 410-205-5563. As always, a big thank you to Baluki for our logo, to Patrick Cortez for our theme music, and of course to Mithil Thelhan for keeping the ship tight and the ball rolling as our executive producer. A special thanks to my research assistant Jennifer Leahy and her mom, and homicide investigator Sarah Kalin, who spent way too long in a car with me driving around New Hampshire.
So I definitely had gotten all the, like, navigated my way out of Manchester and was on the highway. I am going to Ann Burgess's house. She's making me tuna for lunch, so.
I love it.
I know. She's the cutest. She's like, I know you love tuna. Come to my house. I'll make us sandwiches. It'd be lovely to see you.
Oh, that's so nice. All right.
So the reason I wanted to talk is to kind of give you a little bit of interview hint in order, I think, to get the most usable audio, the best audio out of Tom Sexton. So the first thing I'll say is he is absolutely fantastic. He is, without a doubt, bless you, one of the good ones, okay. Right? Okay. So
he also was he was on the scene a lot. He's in a lot of the reports. So
is it, so here's what's interesting. He said he was like, I barely remember. He's like, I don't even know if I was on the scene. And I told him you would know better and that you could probably get him all of these, you know, copies of these documents to help jog his memory.
The only reason, you know, the names that I sent you were the names that appeared the most frequently, basically.
Okay. So his primary memory, and that's really interesting then, if he was so involved, the thing that 33 years later stands out to him the most, because he's like, I think my only involvement was I was the one who interviewed Ken, like, less than 48 hours after she was found.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. And he said he was very cold. You know, everybody mourns differently, kind of that caveat that we all do, but he goes, this was not a man who cared that his wife had just been stabbed to death. He did not care.
Wow. So what did he what did he have to say about Lammy?
He certainly felt that Lammy was a one-of-a-kind investigator, that he was brilliant in his strategizing and in his ways of solving cases, and that he did think of things that other detectives wouldn't think of, and a lot of times it was really successful. But he also said that probably at least half of Lammy's confessions ended up getting thrown out at suppression hearings, which is just like a stunning percentage.
Did he say that this was kind of like a note, like part of his reputation, like it was like people just yes. knew that was okay.
Yeah, and in fact, he said, you know, it's a small state, it's a small system, everybody knows everybody, and everybody sort of knew that that was how he operated in that kind of, you know, unconventional way. He said that Lammy was or is a very imposing figure, just physically, that he's very tall, very big, shaved bald head, and had a sort of twitchy presence that often made people nervous just by him being in the room. And so that he did use that to his advantage mm-hmm. to get people to talk.